Welcome to No Ordinary Life. Most of us are highly aware of the extremely successful people in the world. The Elon Musks, the Warren Buffetts, and of course Steve Jobs. We can't help but hear their stories. Books are written and movies are made about these high performers, these overachievers. And these are great, inspiring stories that show us what can be done when you put your mind to it. But what about the people you've never heard about? The person standing in front of you at the grocery line, the guy down the street who drives the minivan with duct tape on. What about the family that were gone for almost 3 months while someone else lived in their house? These are the stories that no ordinary life will explore. The stories we don't actually get to hear about, but should. Stories about ordinary people. People you may know, but had no idea about the types of choices they've made in order to get to where they are. The risks that they have taken and the decisions that they have made so that they could live no ordinary life.
An interesting thing happened to me when things got going really well. I gave myself permission to break one of my own rules. And I figured, not only was I engaged, things were going great with Jenna. I was her soccer coach, because now I lived in the same town as her. I was her soccer coach for 3-4 seasons in a row. Everyone called me Soccer Mom Tom because I was doing all the soccer stuff. Her and I are having a great relationship. I'm really proud of that. I'm paying a mortgage now on my condo instead of rent. I'm proud of that. Like I've broken the cycle. I've broken the family cycle. First guy in my family to ever go to college. And then in 2001, my gateway drug was MDMA. It was at a party with my fiance, and it didn't happen overnight. It didn't happen in a week, but it happened. Essentially, I went from 0 to 60 very fast.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the No Ordinary Life podcast. I am your host, Brent Rogers, on this fine Mother's Day. For all the moms out there that are listening into the podcast, happy Mother's Day. Hope you're having a great day. We have a great podcast for you today. This is part one of the story of Tom Miller. I was introduced to Tom Miller a little while ago through a former No Ordinary Life guest, Rob Gruppe, who, by the way, you should check out his episode. It's fantastic. But after my podcast with Rob, he said to me, you've got to meet up with my friend Tom. He has an amazing story, and it's one your listeners will really get a lot out of. So fast forward a month or so, and I now have Tom on the show. And true to Rob's word, it is an amazing story, and I think you're really going to enjoy it. Here's Tom's official bio. Coach Tom Miller has over 20 years of experience in the fitness industry and is a bona fide physiology nerd with a degree from UC Davis, has over 10 fitness and nutrition certifications to prove it, including Nutrition Expert Level 3. He developed the cross-function workout system designed for those with a busy schedule. Tom's attention to detail and science has resulted in a 45-minute workout experience that gives more metabolic benefits than 90 minutes of normal working out. So here's the thing, Tom was also a drug addict, which also included cooking meth and selling drugs. Alcohol addiction was next, along with jail time, and then finally, ultimately, freedom from it all. And it's an amazing story. So listen in on part one of my excellent conversation with Tom Miller of Lifelight Fitness, who is living no ordinary life.
I am a very happy, proud CEO of Lifelight Fitness, and I've been a fitness professional and teacher throughout my career. So my entire professional career has been about teaching, coaching, and so forth. I have 4 kids, blended family, a lovely daughter named Jenna, and Jack, Luke, and Dean, my 3 boys, and a wonderful wife named Nicole. And today was a pretty good day. I started my day off from my home office. I went into the gym for a while to make sure everything was going well, checked in with my trainers, got my workout in, and met with some clients, got to come home and get everything ready for this wonderful podcast. So I can say my life today looks enormously different than it did even 8 years ago.
Well, we're going to get into that, absolutely, because you've got a pretty incredible story, Tom, and I think it's probably going to be very interesting for the listeners to hear. Now, you were born in Denver, Colorado, but you didn't stay there long. You ended up moving, correct?
Yeah, the only reason I know I was born there is because my mom told me I was. I don't remember anything about it. You know, it's an interesting start to California. My mom was in a relationship with a man I've never met, and that's actually my biological father. And from my mom's, what she shared with me, he was super into guns, super into crazy stuff, and actually shot her while she was holding me during a fight. And she left him and moved to California and remarried my stepdad. She doesn't really like to talk about those details much, so I don't know anything about my biological dad. However, she did show me the shot wound in her thigh, and I can understand why she doesn't want to talk about it.
So that's a pretty crazy start to life. I mean, at that point, based on your timeline, you were probably around 2 years old. So when did your stepdad come into the picture? Was that an immediate thing in California, or that he came along later?
To be honest, he's all I ever knew. I didn't even find out he was my stepdad until we were in sixth grade. So growing up, he was my dad. However, I should have had a clue because my name's Tom, and my brother's names were Richard, Roger, and Roy, and my stepdad's name was Roy. So as we got older, I looked different. We were, you know, there were signs that showed that, hey, there might be something up here. And sure enough, he was not my biological dad.
Yeah. At a certain point, one of these things doesn't look like the other, I guess. Eh?
Right. And, you know, he treated me, now looking back, he treated me much differently than the other three. And I think that was partly because I wasn't his biological son.
Now, you're the oldest of four boys. How did you get along with the boys? Was it a typical kind of household where rough and tumble, replacing drywall because everybody's wrestling? Or what did that look like, life in your household?
Oh, that's a very good question. And it was sporadic, to say the least. It was there were times when the brothers and I were playing around and we were laughing and singing and everybody was kind of happy, but most of the time it was pretty much chaotic. My mom was a really active alcoholic who later turned into a pretty avid drug user. And my dad, my stepdad, I'm going to just call him dad because that's what I always called him. He was very hung up on prescription medication, pain medication. So they were constantly in and out of getting high, not getting high. And when they run out of stuff, it was worse than when they had stuff. But I think the biggest thing, Brent, is we were super poor. I remember wondering why my mom could afford to buy this big thing of bourbon and we couldn't afford to buy food for the house. And just saying to myself, I will never be like that. So my brothers and I, we kind of took care of each other a bit. And when the 1st and the 15th, that's when we would get some sort of assistance or a social security check. There was a lot of food. And then as the month went on, the food would dwindle and things got a little more chaotic. So I would say from early on, my brothers and I were all sort of, we had to learn how to fend for ourselves, take care of each other. And we got pretty close. But then there was also times where we all had to just kind of take care of ourselves. Me being the oldest, I felt very obligated, even through college, to look out for them, help them out, and try to make sure that they were good.
So it was a chaotic life. You and your brothers were essentially raising yourselves, it sounds like. Did you and your brothers get along? Was it kind of strength in numbers or unity due to adversity?
I would say, yeah, especially in the early years, we were pretty close and we did get along pretty well. And there were four of us. So sometimes, you know, me and the youngest brother would bond more. Sometimes me and the second to the oldest, we all would just sort of... We would kind of hang out with who was there and who was in a good mood that day and who can kind of boost us up a bit. So we definitely relied on each other a bunch early on.
Now, was school any relief for you? Was that kind of a respite for you and your brothers?
You know, it was very interesting. I remember a very pivotal time when I was around sixth or seventh grade. and things got especially bad. Things were really poor. When you're growing up poor, it's people, especially middle school, I mean, they make fun of you because you're wearing the same clothes every day. Your shoes have holes in them. You know, when people come to your house, if they do, it's like very messy. So my self-esteem was an all-time low. And I remember thinking to myself, what the heck? It's like, you know, I didn't realize I was missing certain things at home, like positive reinforcement and stability and things like that. But I just remember feeling like giving up. And I saw some magazine with some guy with abs. And I said to myself, whoa, that was awesome. I want to get some of those. And for the moment I saw that, I just started researching in magazines, started running, started doing crunches and push-ups. And sooner or later, my abs started to show. And it sounds superficial, but for whatever reason, having those abs gave me a sense of self-esteem that I didn't have before then, that I felt like, whoa. And then my body started to get more muscular, and I started to get attention for that. And then I started to do sports, track, football in high school, and I started getting attention from that. And then finally, I said, wow, let's try schoolwork now. And I just applied myself all the way to school and started getting really good grades too. So we all went in different directions at this point. I decided I am going to be amazing. I'm going to be awesome. I'm not going to be poor. I'm not going to be an alcoholic. I'm not going to let any of this stuff happen to me. I'm going to kick butt in school so I can get recognition and feel safer. And I just kept trying to do more and more things to get attention, to get some sort of self-esteem booster. And I wound up doing a lot in high school. I wound up graduating, going to UC Davis. I got some scholarships. I was actually voted, going from the poorest kid in the class to the least popular kid in the class to student body president my senior year.
Wow, that's a big transformation.
I think I'm so passionate about empowering people to add fitness and nutrition to their life in some capacity because it empowered me to get through so many dark holes in my life. And that was a big one because, you know, I think at that age when you're struggling, you just want some form of self-esteem to boost your self-concept. And for me, it started with fitness.
So you graduate as the class president. Where are you going from there? You're headed towards post-secondary. You're looking at university, correct?
Yeah, I went straight to UC Davis. It's a pretty good college here in California, and I did not know what I was doing. I was just applying and getting some financial aid, getting some scholarships, and I got in and I went.
Now, was your daughter born during this time period, or was she after university?
Well, let's back up a tiny bit, because in high school, something dramatic happened that it was going into my sophomore year. And during that time, my stepdad killed himself. And when that happened, my whole family went into turmoil. My mom just definitely went off a deep spiral, my brothers. And at that point, I feel like there was some distance. I tried to be away from the house as much as I could. When I was there, I would try to help, but I knew that when I was there, it would just make me feel horrible and there was nothing I could do. And just having your parental figure kill themselves, and it was a little small town called Arbuckle in California. So everybody had, it just was a very challenging time. And I don't want to be a victim for it and blame it on anything, but it definitely, when you have a parental figure kill themselves, you start worrying that other people in your household are going to do it as well, because it's like an easy, quick way out. And I think that was definitely made me realize that I would never give up no matter how bad things got. And I think that one of my core values for the gym, for my business, and for my life is grit. And that's just get back up and go again. And if it sucks sometimes, it's okay. It's not always going to feel that way, but you got to just keep pushing forward.
That's interesting that you should mention grit. My wife is a personal trainer. And, you know, her kind of theme behind everything she does is grit and grace, you know, and she defines both grit and grace for her clients. so that they can apply it. They can apply it to their lives because both of them are important, right?
That makes all good. You know, the grace of really good form and just fluidity in your movements and just making sure you put form over everything, but the grit to dig in and get it done when it's not very comfortable.
Yeah. So your daughter was born during around this time where your father killed himself?
No, there were some years between that. So my dad killed himself when I was a sophomore in high school. I had to make a decision there to let that just get me down or to dig in more. And what I did when things got bad, I would just do more. I would get better grades. I would work out more. I would, you know, try to get another award of some type, some sort of recognition. Now, Jenna was born. It's an interesting story. I went to school at Davis and worked at the Sonoma County YMCA. And one of the people I worked with, she was lovely and still is. Laura's a lovely, lovely lady. She and I started having a nice little love affair. And I went back to school the next year after the summer working there. And she gave me a call and said, "We're having a baby." And I said, "Wow." She was about 5 or 6 years older than me. And I was scared to death. She was about to graduate from college. I was just starting.
Wow.
So that was not planned. It was not expected. And I did not know how to handle it well.
So how did you handle it?
I would drive to Santa Rosa on the weekends to see her and to see Laura. And the initial plan was for us to get married and raise Jenna together. Early on, I was so scared. I was like, maybe we should give Jenna for adoption. And there was no way in the world. And I'm so glad that people were wiser than me, because that was not a good suggestion. It was just so fearful. And I'd been poor my whole life. I still had not had any money. I wasn't making any money. And here I was bringing a child into this world. And, you know, in a lot of ways, I felt like I was still a kid. And it was definitely scary. And I really regret even suggesting that. But I just have to be completely transparent that I was so scared that that was one of the suggestions I had to Laura. But she was smart enough when her family, who has a very, very strong family foundation, to say, "No, let's do this." And I am so glad that we did.
Yeah, I bet. You know, I mean, at that age, it's tough to know what to do, right? I mean, you're looking at, you know, conceivably your whole life's ahead of you. You're looking forward to getting into college. You're not necessarily mature enough to deal with that, right?
No, and I'm just grateful that other people were making decisions and not me, because I don't, knowing what I know now, I'm so grateful that Jenna's in this world and I'm her dad, and that we're, you know, that we didn't even do the adoption. I mean, it was definitely, sometimes you get intervention from people that know much more than you, and I'm grateful for that.
Yeah. So college, how did you get to college? Were you on a scholarship? Was it due to grades or sports?
I'm going to be very honest. I'm still paying off my student loans. But I got some scholarships. I didn't do college well. I wasn't prepared for how rigorous the coursework was, how much time I needed to spend studying. I was going to see Jenna, you know, hour drive to see her every other weekend. And then I was also bringing my brothers to my college apartment every other weekend or so, because I wanted to make sure they didn't go start doing drugs and they didn't start getting in trouble. So I would try to still connect with them. So I didn't have the typical college life. And up to this point, I've not touched alcohol. I've not touched any drugs whatsoever, because I was determined to be completely opposite of my parents growing up. And I was determined to make something myself and not be poor. So my college was a lot of working out, not as much studying as I needed, and a lot of girlfriends and Jenna and my brothers. It was after Jenna's mom and I went separate ways after one summer together, when trying to do it, we realized that was not going to work. But we've had a really good relationship ever since.
Now, you mentioned during college that, at least to me, not to the listeners, but you mentioned during college that you worked for the YMCA as a camp counselor. So it sounds to me like that had some significance to you because you actually mentioned it.
It was the most fun job I've ever had up to the one I have now. I basically got to do sports camps with kids all the time. And that is also where I met Jenna's mom, Laura. She was actually my camp director and I was a camp counselor. And that's how Jenna was brought into this world.
So then after college, where are you headed now?
Well, what happened is every summer I would go back to the YMCA and work there again. And that made it so I could be closer to Jenna. And I got to know the YMCA company. I loved working with kids. And I just, you know, by my fourth year going back, I was, you know, camp director. And then they hired me as the youth sports coordinator for the entire YMCA County after it was the Sonoma County YMCA. So after I graduated, I got like an entry-level director job for the YMCA.
And then from the YMCA, you moved towards teaching.
It was an awesome story. I had done some instructional assistant work for an elementary school. And during that time, I made a really good friend and a really good impression and with the principal. Her name is Gail Hollis. But the instructional assistant job, you just have to basically have a college degree and pass an aptitude test and you can do it. It's not, you don't need a credential or a certification. So I did that for a school year, went back to the YMCA and was working there. And then one day she calls me and says, "Tom, how would you like to be a teacher?" And I said, "I don't have a teaching credential." Well, in California at that time, they had just did the classroom reduction, and they were allowing teachers to teach with emergency credentials. And she said she really liked the energy I brought when I was there. She feels like I'd be a great fit. I can interview for the job, and I can get my emergency credential and go to school to get my credential while we're going. So at that time, I loved the idea of going back to teaching. I did not love sitting at a desk at the YMCA, and I did it.
Gail had a big impact on that in terms of bringing it to your attention and also encouraging you to do that. Is you ended up having to take the night courses in order to get the teaching credentials. So now you're back at school getting that done. And you know, once you've got your credentials, you know, everything's in place. It sounds to me like life is good at that point.
I'm going to tell you, man, teaching came very natural to me and I loved it. And I was tenured pretty early on. I did the night classes, got my actual credential. And I actually started at that same time, about 5 years into it, my own personal training business called True Results Fitness. So I'm teaching during the day, getting my workouts in, doing personal training a couple times a week. And on the weekends, I'm making more money than I've ever made before. For me, not being poor, by the way, is like being rich. So I felt rich because I could pay all the bills. I had all the food I needed in the refrigerator. And I met a very, very loving, beautiful woman named Rima at Gold's Gym, and her and I became engaged.
So this is a big step. You know, you've got kind of your act together. You're gainfully employed. You're appealing as husband material, and now you're engaged. So I'm expecting that you're riding off into the sunset at this point.
Yeah, I had it made. Everything was going great and I loved my life. So an interesting thing happened to me when things got going really well. I gave myself permission to break one of my own rules. And I figured not only was I engaged, things were going great with Jenna. I was her soccer coach. Because now I lived in the same town as her. I was her soccer coach for 3-4 seasons in a row. Everyone called me Soccer Mom Tom because I was doing all the soccer stuff. Her and I are having a great relationship. I'm really proud of that. I I'm paying a mortgage now on my condo instead of rent. I'm proud of that. Like I've broken the cycle. I've broken the family cycle. First guy in my family to ever go to college. And then in 2001, my gateway drug was MDMA. It was at a party with my fiance, and it didn't happen overnight. It didn't happen in a week, but it happened. Essentially, I went from 0 to 60 very fast. First, it was every other weekend. On the weekends I didn't have Jenna, I would do ecstasy and smoke pot, and never alcohol. Interesting thing is, even though I was breaking my rules, I still didn't want it to have calories. I didn't want it to be bad for my body.
Oh, man.
So, but this little pill, I was like, wow, that could do a lot. And then the marijuana to calm down later. And so it got to the point where I was just looking forward to it. And then it got to the point where I was trying to figure out ways we could do it when it wasn't the weekend. And I really started exhibiting a lot of addictive behavior. But it got worse after that.
Now, where's your fiance in this? Is she battling with you on this? Is she joining you on this? Where does she fit into the picture at this point?
So I want to preface this by saying I do not blame anybody for my fall into addiction but myself. However, she was the one that introduced me to all this. She was the one that, you know, she partied and she was really good at it. And she stopped when it was time to stop. And I didn't want to stop when it was time to stop. I wanted to keep going.
Yeah.
So it was, we did it together.
Right. And so your using started to escalate from there?
Now, I was at the gym working out, and someone at the gym, I asked him, I said, how do you recover so fast? And he told me about this stuff called Renutrient. And what that is GHB, gamma hydroxybutyric acid. And sure enough, when you take it before bed, you wake up the next day and you're not sore and you sleep great. So I fell in love with GHB. Now, a lot of people have never heard about it. It has since been called a date rape drug also, along with roofies, because if you put it with alcohol, it will literally knock someone out. And it went from being available at GNC and supplement stores to being a Schedule 3 drug. So I decided it's good for me. I like it. I'm going to still get it.
Now, are you using it just because it helps with your recovery, or is it similar to the effect that pot or Molly will have where you get high? Is this strictly just helping you with your workouts?
At first, I didn't know you could get high with it. At first, I only did it before bed. And then one day, I did it a little early and wound up not going to bed. And I said, wow, I feel great. And then it became my new party drug.
So what happened from there?
Oh, man, it became harder and harder to get, and I met someone that had made it. I asked him to show me how, and I learned to make it. And I started making it first for myself, and then people would ask me for it. And during this whole process, I'm using, you know, I'm partying on the weekends. I'm doing everything but drinking. By this time, I've added meth to the mix. So now I feel like, you know, my sense of judgment is pretty much going out the window by this time. And the first time I sold a bottle of the GHB to someone, it was such a rush that I almost got addicted to that. Because I learned to make it, I kept making it, and I would use it for myself, and I would sell it.
You realize that you're starting to sound like a real-life version of Breaking Bad to a degree.
Yeah. To be honest, when I watch that show, I have to turn it off usually mid-episode. It's really challenging for me to watch.
I bet. So now you've added meth to the rotation. Where does Jenna fit in all this? Are you seeing her less because of your usage, or are you able to cover it up? What's going on there?
Until I added meth to the mix, it was business as usual with Jenna. The GHB, it wasn't having the impact on me that adding meth did. So until I added meth to my lineup, I was okay I definitely not as good as I was sober, but I was showing up, I was hanging out, I was doing the dad thing, I was still doing soccer. But when I added meth, then her mom said, you know what, she's going to need to take a break from coming to your house. And the thing about meth is you don't think anyone else can notice. You feel like you are so tuned in that you're surprised that anyone would say anything, but everybody notices.
What is it that they're noticing?
I believe it's just the hyperactive movements, the lack of focus, just the sporadic spazziness that happens. I think that I would do more and more of it more frequently, not really aware of how much I was doing.
Yeah, it's a bit like people who are drunk trying to pretend that they're not drunk, thinking everybody thinks they're okay.
Yeah, I would say it's very much like that.
So are you selling meth as well?
No, I would sometimes trade it, but the meth was just I kept taking more and more, and you start feeling groggy and nodding off, but the meth was a good counterpart to not do that. And meth, for whatever reason, the first time I did meth, I absolutely loved it. I was just like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. I have had pretty good at, ADHD for the majority of my life, still now. So the first time I did it, it made me feel very focused, very able to concentrate, and really happy. I think one of the things is I have struggled with anxiety, depression, a lot of typical things that drug use really helped cover up, and meth was automatic.
So, are you still teaching at this point, and you're able to kind of be a functioning meth head, I guess, at this point?
The moment I added meth to the mix, I was called in by my principal. This is one of the people I really admire and feel a lot of gratitude towards. And she basically got me in the door for teaching, was one of my biggest advocates, and I love her to death, and just I respect what she's done for education. So when she called me in and asked me, Tom, what's going on? I lied and told her nothing. And she said she really doesn't think it's nothing. She thinks something's going on. And I was lying to everyone about everything, especially when it came to any drug use, because I didn't want to stop. I didn't want to own it. And I still thought I could carry on and people weren't going to notice that much. So I wrote that day off as a fluke, like, oh, I was just off. So she noticed. Sure enough, the next week, not only does she notice, she gives me 2 weeks of paid leave to get myself together. So she is bending over backwards to try to help me. And I'm still lying to her, telling her that I'm not doing anything, that I'm just tired, or that I, maybe I drank too much caffeine. And just telling these things that I look back now and, man.
Yeah, she's throwing you a lifeline.
Yeah, and she did, until I just kept taking that lifeline and throwing it back at her and telling her I didn't want it. Eventually, and this is super embarrassing for me, and it's not my favorite part of the story, but eventually she called me to the office, and I go, here we go again. It was a Friday, and there was a police officer there. At that point, the police officer gave me some field sobriety tests and asked me if I'd be willing to do a pee test. I said, heck no. And they wanted to know why I wouldn't. And essentially, Gail said it was a very good idea that I don't come back, and that I was relieved from duty for the rest of the year. And basically let me go. But, if you're a tenured teacher, she can't just let you go. And then I decided I'm going to save my job. So I checked myself into a rehab that next week, And, you know, during the rehab, I stopped using meth altogether. I stopped doing everything except sneaking GHB in. Like, GHB was the thing that I just kept doing throughout that. And then the moment I got out of the rehab, I started using again full speed. But during the rehab, I'm writing letters to Gail saying, hey, I apologize. I want to get myself together. And she basically said, you know what? The best thing for you and for us is for you to resign. And she had a list of accounts that teachers had reported something. It breaks my heart that I let myself do that. And to be honest, when I tell my story, I want to leave this part out because just, you know, to be around kids and allow yourself to keep using drugs behind the scenes, thinking you're okay. I'm just grateful no one ever got hurt, that, you know, there was no danger. But at the same time, it's just super irresponsible of me. And I know that. And even today, it feels horrible when I think of it.
Yeah. The fact that you're feeling guilty even now is not surprising to me. You know, it's you kind of look back on these things and think, man, what was I thinking? But, you know, you were a full-out addict at that point, that's for sure. So that's, you went to rehab. It didn't take. You got out. Gail's asked you to resign, so you've had to resign. Where do you go from here? Back to rehab?
No, I decide, you know, I'm going to make some money and then I'm going to get a normal job. And at this time, my fiance has left me. I am by myself because I just kept leaving. This is another thing. The wedding was called off like months before it was going to happen because I kept disappearing on drug adventures. And she told me, she said, you know, if you keep doing this, we have to call the wedding off. I'm going to move out. And I said, okay, I'll stop. And I didn't. And she did move out. So here I am living on my own. And I have all the freedom in the world now. So I decided to make a whole bunch of money selling GHB.
So is there a big market for GHB? Does that tend to focus around, the fitness world or?
But this time it crossed over and the party and the rave scene were doing it. And a person approached me and asked me if I could make him 5 to 10 gallons at a time for an absurdly large amount of money. And I had to make a decision to, yes or no? And I decided yes. And then everything got really crazy.
Why don't you tell us about that?
You know, there was like 3 times in my life where I almost died. And the first one was when my mom was holding me and my biological dad shot her. The second was during this time in my life when I did not know what I was doing. I'm interacting with these pretty heavy duty drug dealers and I'm making it and selling it. And I got myself into a few situations that honestly, I am lucky to be alive from. You know, anytime you're selling drugs at that capacity and something goes wrong, there are guns, there are just scary situations where I was not equipped to handle. And I was, to be honest, pretty darn scared. It's just when I don't want to really glorify it at all, but when there's so much money at one time and if anything goes wrong or anyone's suspicious, next thing you know, someone's threatening your life with a gun and telling you to make it right and then explaining to them that it is. So that happened on 2 different occasions and it's still wasn't enough to say, hey, don't do this ever again. It was almost like I was so addicted to that much money at one time. It was amazing. And then it wasn't even, when I got it like that, it wasn't even like it was real money. But it was just so amazing that I could create that much money at one time. And that's just I kept taking risk after risk.
So did these risks start to lead to encounters with the law, or were you able to kind of skirt by that? I mean, you're, what did you say? 5 gallon bins of GHB, that, like, you've got a lot of product on you.
Right. What happened was I got in trouble for possession of meth. I got in trouble a couple times with possession of meth and got arrested for the first time for possession of meth. And it wasn't really, you know, the GHB at that point, it was the meth. And, you know, I had so much money, I was able to bail out. I was able to get a good lawyer. And that happened like 3 times where it was just possession. And I was just careless, foolish. I was just not able to make good decisions as far as don't use it in your car when the police are driving by, or don't, you know, don't let it pull out of your. Oh, I'm going to tell you a story that is not my proudest story, but this will show you how crazy I am, or how crazy the meth will make you. Jen and I, because I would go through phases. I wasn't always just so out of it that I couldn't function. I would like stop for periods of time, the meth and everything else. And I would have good times. And during those times, Jen and I would see each other again. And we were on our annual trip to San Francisco to go shopping together. But I had not had meth for a while. And I, this is another one I'm super not proud of. So just advance warning. This is not a good one, but it's the story. And so I want to share it. We went there and I had a guy meet me at the mall that Jen and I were at. And I bought a little baggie of meth from that person. You know, I had put it in my back pocket, was planning on using it when I got home. Well, when I'm driving back with Jenna, we're talking and I get pulled over, I think because of speeding or a lane violation, but I get pulled over. And when the police comes to the car and says, can I see your ID? I pull out my wallet and the bag of meth pops out.
Oh, man.
And I get arrested right in front of my daughter.
How old was she at this point?
12.
Oh, she knows what's going on.
Oh, she knew exactly what was going on. Her mom had to come pick her up from the Marin police station. And I passed all the sobriety tests because I luckily had not been using it. And there were no charges there. But I was charged again with possession.
And were you able to bail yourself out again, or was this?
That was the cycle until that cycle ended. I had a period of time where I was just pretty much using every day, isolating from most people, and my ex-fiance and I were still seeing each other from time to time and still partying together from time to time. It was super unhealthy situation. And the thing that connected us was G. And we would do it together still. I would make it for her. And it was just a tough situation as far as seeing reality. So the way it made, when I made the GHB, it was delivered to my house. I decided, since the delivery didn't come, to go to DHL to pick it up. And when I went to pick it up, I was high. So they didn't release it to me. They said to come back tomorrow. And again, this is one of the ingredients to make it with, the main ingredient. And I went back tomorrow, but he was dressed like a DHL guy, but he wasn't. In fact, the whole place was surrounded with federal agents. And I was arrested then, and there was going to be no bailing myself out.
Wow. And now you're looking at real repercussions.
Yeah. Everything, everything at that moment changed. And I wasn't aware how bad it was at that point because I had had such a pattern of getting arrested for lots of different things and bailing myself out, you know, getting arrested, bailing myself out, going to court, paying a lawyer. And this was different because there was no bailing myself out. And in the federal courts, you go to pretrial and do a pretrial case. And the only bail I got was to be released to a rehab program. Like, I was not free to go home. I was not free to wear an ankle monitor or anything like that. I had to go to a drug rehabilitation program while I awaited trial.
So when you get to rehab, I'm assuming at this point you've sobered up.
Oh, yeah.
Is there a point where there's some reflection where you're like, I've broken all my rules. This is what I swore I would never do, yet I've broken all my rules. Does that reflection not happen?
At that point, I'm in survival mode again. I'm thinking, how can I get out of this trouble? First is I need to do awesome at this rehab. And then I need to, I need to get my life back together because I have squandered everything. And at this point, I'm not super, like, I wasn't even considering how it affected other people at that time. To be honest, I was so selfish. I was just thinking, how can I get myself out of this? And the first step was to do awesome at this rehab.
And that sounds, you know, I was talking to Rob Gruppe last weekend, because that's how you and I connected. And he said something similar. You know, there wasn't really any thought of anybody else.
Yeah. And I love Rob, by the way. I'm grateful that he introduced us. And him and I haven't even discussed that. And had you not asked me, I wouldn't even been aware of it or cognizant of it, that I wasn't thinking of anyone else. I was thinking, how can I get myself out of this? How can I, you know, get money again? How can I not be in trouble? And the first step was to do awesome at this rehab.
So how did you do?
You know, I'm going to preface this again by saying I do not blame anything on anyone else, but I would sometimes when I would leave for work, I would hang out with my, because after a certain point in the rehab, you get to go work. And sometimes I wouldn't really work. I would go and see Rima and we would drink. So by this time I decided I'm not doing more drugs. I'm done.
Well, I was going to ask because it seems, correct me if I'm wrong, at this point, all you did was drugs. Like you had even said earlier on in our discussion that you still hadn't touched alcohol.
Yeah, alcohol was absolutely, like, I know what alcohol does to your body, and I did not want that. So I had sworn it off. But now they're drug testing me, and alcohol is going to be out of your system, you know, in about 3 or 4 hours. So I can drink a little bit as long as I stop before I go back, and they will never know. And they, you know, they usually always pee test me because I wasn't a drinker, so they weren't going to breathalyze me anyway unless I'm acting drunk. So I get away with this at the rehab probably 5 or 6 times. And the 7th time, though, I drank way too much. And I was drunk when I got back. And we were talking and they were calling me out on it. And I left. I left the rehab. I caught a bus, took it to my ex-fiance's house, and hung out for a while.
Now, are you allowed to leave rehab at this point?
Oh my God, no. That was one of the worst decisions I made through the whole process. At that moment, not only did I violate my pretrial, I'd have to spend the rest of it now in jail. I also made myself a flight risk. So when I was sentenced to a prison, I would no longer go to a camp. I would go to a medium security now.
Oh.
Just thinking about what a bad, bad decision that was. That made everything worse.
I bet.
Man, I cannot wait to get to the happy part of this story. Oh, man.
Ooh, boy. So that's where we're going to leave it. I hate to kind of cut you off, but we ended up having like a two-hour conversation. If you think the stakes are high right now, wait till you hear the rest of Tom's story and how he finally breaks free from both his past and his demons and I guess also his addictions. As always, please give us a review and a rating at iTunes. It really helps. And don't forget to tell all your friends. Part two of Tom's story will be available next week. And with that, I will sign off saying Happy Mother's Day to all the moms out there who I'm sure are living no ordinary lives. Thank you.